It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin's Public Service Commission is holding a pair of public hearing sessions today on a proposal from We Energies to create a separate energy rate for large energy customers like data centers.
That comes as some utility customers worry that a data center's significant energy needs could drive up the energy bills for other ratepayers.
The PSC says its jurisdiction to decide on the proposal will be based on the, quote, reasonableness of the rates, terms, and conditions of electric service, end quote, and not about the broader debate around data center development in the state.
We're learning more about the proposed energy rate changes and what they would mean for Wisconsin energy customers.
Brendan Conway is here, Director of Media Relations for WEC Energy Group, which operates We Energy. Brendan, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Good morning, Kate.
Why do you want to create a separate energy rate for large energy users like data centers?
Yeah, well, we're really proud of this transparent process, this transparent proposal. You mentioned today, obviously, two public hearings. That's part of this transparent process. You know, about a year ago, before people across the state, across the country were really talking about and focusing on data center and energy rates, that's when we first made this proposal. So we've been thinking about this for a long time. And we've said since day one, we will not support shifting any costs from data centers to our other customers. The data centers, you know, to their credit, they've agreed with that. You've heard recently both Microsoft and OpenAI have come out publicly and said, yeah, we want to pay our fair share. I know you're talking to Tom with Cub a little bit later, and I think he'd probably agree that, you know, we've been really open about this. This proposal is focused on making sure there is no cost shift from data centers to customers. And a lot of people across the country are looking at this proposal, our proposal, as kind of like the gold standard, things that other states should probably be looking to adopt. And so we're going to be interested to hear what the public thinks today.
Well, how can you ensure that your regular customers will not carry the load of the scale that you have to increase electricity power? You know, and you have this 75-25 rate split between data centers and regular customers, splitting the cost of the data center fixed costs. Can you explain why that 75-25 split is right?
Sure. So to start, the reason we're sure is because that's why we're making this proposal, right? We don't have a rate right now. Matter of fact, the only rate we have right now for any large customer that our other large customers use, if data centers were to be part of that existing rate, it'd be about $1.5 billion cost shift because of how it doesn't protect our customers. That 75-25, there's been a lot of misinformation, a lot of, I think, miscommunication. So happy to talk about that. Our proposal is basically three things. Number one, a term agreement, service agreement, data centers. We're going to commit to cover all of our costs. You know, here's a line of credit, those type of things. Okay. Then we have two kind of power plant proposals. One is what we call a full capacity power plant. A lot of those are going to be renewable energy plants. Data centers will pay the full amount for those plants. And that's what they're going to receive energy from. They'll also receive energy credits from that. The other part is what we call this 75-25% capacity only plant. That is simply existing to increase the capacity to serve all of our customers. Data centers will pay 75% to build that. Other customers will pay 25%. And then other customers, so non-data center customers, will receive 100% of all the energy, all the benefits from it. We expect over the life of those plants, that would be a few hundred million dollars in benefits they will receive, not cost, benefits.
Where do those benefits come from? Is that from, you know, energy markets? Can you explain?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, so the way it works in Wisconsin is we're at all of our power plants, like any utility, we sell into this regional market, serves 15 states, and our customers then buy out of that regional market. When prices are really high, so think about 2 weeks ago when it was incredibly cold, prices were really high. Our power plants were selling into the market. They're being bought across the region, customers from other states. Profit we made, we're going back to our customers because they had invested in that. And, you know, just to put a finer point on the 75-25, we did that looking at past historical practice, right? What has the commission often looked at? And in fact, the commission's own staff acknowledged that in their testimony, that 75-25 allocation is consistent with how they've done it.
What would happen if data centers use less energy or leave the state of Wisconsin? You know, who foots the bill then? Would energy customers, regular customers, be left with the bill for all of these plants?
Short answer is no. And that's, again, what's so important about having this proposal that we made, because data centers will have to pay for those plants. So we have commitments, signed agreements with those plants or with those data centers, I should say, that if they were somehow to leave and we couldn't repurpose those plants, well, obviously, if we could repurpose them for another data center, that would be a thing. They would be responsible for paying that. We have that all signed agreements. And those agreements have been filed with the Public Service Commission. I mean, they see those things. And so we wanted to really make sure in the front end, no costs were shifted from data centers to other customers.
And very quickly, how long would data centers have to be running for their higher energy rate to fully cover the costs associated with powering them?
Well, they would be paying the full amount of the plant. So let's say there's a solar plant that we're building, round number, let's say $100 million, and they're going to get 80% of the energy from that. They would pay that $80 million. The other 20%, so the other $20 million, would go to other customers, the energy. We're going to always need to have more energy. So they would pay from day one. So it's not like we're not recovering over time. They're paying the cost. In fact, they've committed, even in advance as we build these things, they've committed that if for some reason the Public Service Commission was to deny one of these plants and to say you couldn't build them, but we have already spent money, you know, engineering them, the data centers will pay for that. So we've really made sure no cost will be shifted from data centers to other customers.
Brendan, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Brendan Conway is Director of Media Relations for We Energies. He was with us to share his company's proposal for a separate energy rate structure for large energy customers that are on the scale of data centers. Now we're going to hear from one of the groups that opposes this rate structure change. Tom Content is here, Executive Director of the Citizens Utility Board. Tom, welcome back.
Oh, thanks. Good to be with you.
What concerns does the Citizens Utility Board, this advocacy group, have about this We Energies proposal before the PSC?
It's just a matter of how this gets implemented and whether the protections that the We Energies is talking about are really solid enough. And we think clearly We Energies and the tech companies have been saying all the right things about paying their fair share. And so we said the devil's in the detail, trust but verify. And then when our team dug in, we found some loopholes where customers could be on the hook. It's part of it is through that 75-25 thing where customers could be on the hook for all the fuel costs for the power plants, for the fossil fuel power plants that would be needed as part of the $6 billion of new investment that's planned. Of the projects that were just announced recently on this. And the bottom line is that this is a massive increase in our energy use. And so I think that's where the PSC needs to really go through this with a fine tooth comb. And even the PSC staff analysts have raised concerns similar to ours.
Well, let me ask you this. Is this proposal from We Energies better than the status quo? I mean, would the PSC be better off implementing this rate structure proposal than changing nothing at all?
Oh, it definitely needs to change. We support the fact that there's a tariff for data centers to segregate these costs. And at a high level, we think that they've come close to hitting the mark, actually, but there are a lot of loopholes. So if this were a bucket, it would be leaking water. And so the PSC needs to actually plug those holes to make this sound for all customers and make sure that costs don't spread to those other customers.
How would the Citizens Utility Board like to see this proposal altered?
First of all, I think they bring down the size of the data center or the data centers that would be eligible for this. Second of all, make sure that the tech companies are actually putting up the money for all the massive amounts of new power plants that are needed. We Energies has an out clause where the tech companies wouldn't have to put up all the money. They could achieve compliance with a good credit rating, and good credit ratings are all in a volatile tech economy don't always last because the tech industry can be volatile. And longer, we think the contracts should be longer term. And then we
like
also
the contract is 10 years. Why is that a concern?
Other states have required those contracts to be longer, 15, 20 years. When you think about how power plants are paid for, all of our prices, utility customers' prices go up when a power plant comes online. But that doesn't mean it's all paid off in 1 year because these are so expensive. And these are paid off over 40 or 50 years, depending on the plant. little less for solar, but it to make sure that if you've got $6 billion in new infrastructure plus another $2 billion that the PSC approved last year largely for Microsoft, protections need to be in place, and the tech companies are so wealthy that they can certainly afford to do this. They're more concerned about getting their data centers running, and that's why they're ready to pay a premium. We just don't think that the premium's always in the agreements that have been filed in this case.
How open do you think the Public Service Commission will be to the feedback that it receives on this proposal?
I think they will be open because this is the case. This is the first case of any data center pricing coming before the commission. And when you think about the massive energy use of AI data centers, it's literally doubling the We Energy system. So for two data centers in Racine County and Ozaukee County, you're actually adding the equivalent amount of energy as more than 1 million customers use today. And so that's why getting this right is so important. And
You mentioned, Tom, this is the first attempt to craft a rate structure for data center scale customers here in Wisconsin. Very quickly, do you expect more proposals in the future from other energy companies?
Yes. Alliant Energy has a case that we're involved with right now that's going to hearing in 2 weeks from today. So this one's today. These PSC hearings involving We Energies are today. The one involving the Alliant project for Meta and Beaver Dam is 2 weeks from today Xcel Energy just announced last week that they're going to be filing a data center tariff in Wisconsin this year as well.
Tom, thanks for the update.
Thank you.
Tom Content, Executive Director of the Citizens Utility Board, with us to share his group's opposition to a proposal from We Energies to create a separate energy rate structure for data centers. Earlier, we heard from We Energy spokesperson Brendan Conway about why the utility is proposing this rate change. The Public Service Commission is accepting public comment on this proposal until February 17th.
Coming up, people in prison or jail face high costs for basic care products and communication with their families. Meet two spouses of Wisconsin inmates who are calling for a change.
We're oftentimes already struggling, and then to have to pay for all this is just terrible. It has a terrible impact on families across the state.
That's next here on Wisconsin Today. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Affordability is top of mind for people with concerns over inflation and the costs of healthcare, medicine, and groceries.
One segment of the population is having a similar affordability crisis, but they're earning even lower wages and paying even higher prices, people in the Wisconsin jail and prison system.
Incarcerated people or their families have to pay for things that aren't considered necessities, like lotion, shampoo, deodorant, over-the-counter medicine, phone calls, entertainment, and even healthcare, and many of those are only available at a large markup.
One Wisconsin bill working its way through the legislature right now would limit the cost of hygiene items in jails and prisons. And since 2024, the Federal Communications Commission has been debating limits on the amount that those institutions can charge for phone and video calls.
Rebecca Aubert and Susan Franzen have been directly affected by these extra costs because they have loved ones incarcerated.
They met while waiting in line to visit their family members at a Wisconsin correctional facility. They decided to form Ladies of Solutions, Change and Innovation, or SCI, ever since they've been advocating for better jail and prison conditions in the state. Susan Franzen is Director of Operations for Ladies of SCI, and Rebecca Aubert is Executive Director of the group. Rebecca, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
And Susan, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having us here today.
Susan, let's start with the basics here. People might assume that if you're in jail or you're in prison, that those facilities will give you all the basic necessities that you need. Well, it's more complicated than that. What is normally provided and what do people have to pay for themselves?
Yeah. When I was introduced to this world several years ago, I had a lot of preconceived notions of what our state provides for our prisoners. And unfortunately, they don't provide a whole lot. Very limited hygiene items, a toothbrush, toothpaste, soap, some basic clothing. But when the loved one that I support ended up being placed in prison, I spent just under $2,000 getting him everything he needs just to survive day to day. So socks, underwear, shampoo, you know, deodorant, all of those things. So there's actually a lot that our state does not provide for our prisoners.
And Rebecca, I understand you have a similar story about the costs of providing all of those basics. What did that mean for you and your family?
Yes, it's very, very, very expensive. Just getting my husband what he needed, just like Susan stated, when he first went to prison, cost us about $1,500. And leading up to that, really, we had already spent thousands of dollars just communicating while he was in the local jail. So by that point, we were already thousands into it, and it had only been about 6 months. It's very expensive.
Let's look at these personal items now. Rebecca, you've and your group have looked at documents from the State Department of Corrections that detail what it pays for personal items, how much it sells them to prisoners for in the canteen, how it compares to if you or I went to a retail store to buy similar things. What do you find out when you start to compare and contrast those numbers?
Well, for starters, we have to remember that just about every single item that we purchase as family members has some type of commission attached to it. And in order to make those commissions, I'm sure that's part of the price problem, but many items are marked up between 200 to 500%. And it depends on really where you are. The jails are very different from the prisons. And the prisons, family members can actually purchase things like hygiene supplies separately from what the residents of our prisons can off of their commissary. And what we have found is the prices for family members are oftentimes astronomically higher than they even charge the residents, which, of course, a lot of times they're making about $8 a week. But the families who are trying to support people are actually hit the hardest. Some items can be marked up as much as 600%. For instance, a hygiene order that I purchased for my husband of the cost of $75 through one of their vendors, that's something that family members can purchase. If I were to go to Walmart, that same order would cost me about $20. And that's just one of the very many expenses that we have.
And Susan, people listening might think off the top of their head, I did at first, well, couldn't I just, you know, go to the store, the Walmart or whatever, buy the thing and give it to the family member? Well, then, no, hang on. There are reasons they don't do that. The only option, it sounds like, is through the commissary or whatever it's called at a particular prison or jail. Do I have that right?
Correct. Yes, we can only order items from pre-approved vendors that have contracts with the DOC, obviously for security reasons, to make sure that no contraband is coming in. But yes, our options are very limited. We are not allowed to make our own choices on where or what we buy.
And Rebecca, you mentioned those commissions, the prison or jail is making money in effect on these products. Do we know what that money then is used for?
Well, surprising to us, we found that there actually is no rules for them to follow as far as how much commission that they can get or what they are to do with the commissions. And just like every prison, every single county, for instance, does it different. And so with the counties, we've had, I think, 29 counties respond of the 71 that have jails. And the commissions on their phone calls, for instance, are anywhere between 12% all the way up to 92%, the average being about 44%. And when we asked them what they did with those funds, everybody had a different answer. But one of the common themes was that that money is put into the county's general fund to reduce the cost on the taxpayers for the jail. The problem with that is we on average have about 0.2% of a county's population is in the jail. So we're really shifting that burden to the 0.2% that are in the jail and their families. And oftentimes they aren't the people that have any money to begin with. You know, we're oftentimes already struggling, and then to have to pay for all this, it has a terrible impact on families across the state.
Now, Susan, there's a bill in the state legislature right now that would require facilities to make hygiene products available at prices similar to retail and to give each person a small stipend to spend on those products. Talk a little bit about that legislation and how much of a solution you see that being to the problem.
Yes, they've proposed two different bills. One is for feminine hygiene. The other is for regular hygiene. It does put price caps in place between 125 and 150%. We were excited to see this legislation be presented as it would help reduce some of that burden that we as support people have to pay. I think there might be some more cost-effective ways to do it than the $25 a month stipend, but either way, this bill is definitely moving things in the right direction to help reduce that burden that we feel.
Now, Rebecca, we were talking about these healthcare items, these body aid type items. You also mentioned the cost of communication, especially in jail, but I know this can be an issue in prison. What kind of costs do people incur just to stay in touch with the outside world?
It can be very expensive. The prisons are much cheaper to talk to a loved one, 6 cents a minute. 4 of that 6 cents, though, does get deposited directly into Wisconsin's general fund. So the state is actually profiting off of those calls. The jails, on the other hand, can be crazy. Just our local jail costs about $4.25 for a 15-minute call. There's some jails that are even higher than that. The cost to communicate, especially when you have a loved one that's in jail, is devastating. And to be honest, a lot of times when your loved one is in jail is right when you're starting this process of jail and prison, and that's when families and their loved ones need the most support. So they're kind of taking advantage of that.
I think it's important for your listeners to know that we pay for every form of communication that we have with our loved ones on the inside, whether it be phone calls, emails, sending documents in the mail. Everything has a cost associated with it. Nothing is free except for the 2 calls they get a week that are free.
And just about everything has a commission attached to it.
We are talking to Rebecca Aubert and Susan Franzen of the group Ladies of Solutions Change and Innovation, or SCI. We're talking with them about what incarcerated people and their families have to pay for things like hygiene products, food, entertainment, phone calls, and where that money goes. We heard from Eddie Brooks, who was just released from Stanley Correctional Facility after being incarcerated for 2.5 years. He explained how the kind of financial hardships we're talking about make it harder for incarcerated people to improve their lives. Here's a listen.
The majority of people in prison are living hard. And again, I understand the prison is a place where a person's supposed to have it easy at, but there still should be a standard of living for individuals that supports growth and mental prosperity and emotional well-being and mental health.
Susan, that takes us to the next step here. Okay, yes, there are these financial burdens. What do these worries mean for the effort to come out of prison in a better place than you went into it?
Yeah, it adds more stress to an already stressful situation. So it's just another issue that compounds pain economically. We're paying with our mental health, we're paying emotionally. You're concerned on keeping things going on the outside, and you're trying to be a support person because as support people, we are statistically the most significant way to reduce recidivism. But all of these things compounding, it feels like the weight of the world is on your shoulders, and you're just trying to be strong for that person that's on the inside so they can be successful when they get back out.
And Rebecca, basically the same question for you. People might hear about this and not feel a lot of sympathy here, but what does it mean for the outcomes and for what it costs us as a society in the long run?
Well, honestly, we have a very high percentage of people in prisons that already have a mental health diagnosis. And then to struggle for years to just have soap and to be able to brush your teeth and wash a load of clothes, that struggle stays with them. And I'm not sure how we're rehabilitating anybody when your focus every day is to just get enough to eat and get a bar of soap and maybe afford a phone call home. You're really not focusing on anything else. So it's the impact is great. It hurts people's mental health. Just not being able to talk to families when you need to is devastating for both the families and the people that are incarcerated.
Susan, as you work for changes on these issues, among other things, you've gone to state lawmakers, but within the Department of Corrections system itself, who are the deciders? Who are the people you try to talk to influence these decisions about what things cost for people who are incarcerated?
Yes, we've had several meetings with DOC leadership. Their contract people are procuring these contracts, agreeing to the terms that these vendors set up. At this point, we're really hopeful because the new leadership with Secretary Hoy has been very open to hearing our voices and hearing how this affects the people that support those on the inside. So as an advocacy group, we're just going to keep talking to them, making sure that our viewpoint is considered so that way when these contracts come up for renewal, they can start thinking about what this is really doing for their overall goal of helping people be successful when they get out.
Rebecca, are there other states that you think handle this better, have better systems in place than Wisconsin does?
Yes. Actually, I believe all of our surrounding states. All of our surrounding states also have an office of some type called ombudsman or independent oversight, which can help make long-term changes to bad policies in general. So yes, all of our surrounding states are doing better. Minnesota, particularly, they are about the same size as Wisconsin. They have about the same number of people, but they incarcerate about a third of the people that Wisconsin does. They also don't have such strict truth in sentencing rules, so people can earn their way out. While every state who has a prison system has problems, Minnesota is doing overall much better than us here in Wisconsin.
Susan, Rebecca just mentioned that idea of an ombudsperson to oversee Wisconsin's prison system. That role would, as I understand it, investigate complaints involving Wisconsin's Department of Corrections, tackle some of the issues we've been talking about. There was some effort to get that into the state budget, eventually didn't end up going through. What do you see as the potential? What's the case you'd make for having that role?
Yes, when Governor Evers put out his budget initially, there was earmarked some funds to create an ombuds office, and we were excited to see that. Unfortunately, that was stripped out of the budget by the Joint Finance Committee. So at this time, our group still is asking our lawmakers to consider the creation of this office. And we do have some interest in it. However, of course, anything that would add money or offices to the government, unfortunately, the Republicans are very wary to consider that. But that is why we started our advocacy, because as a family member, we had no one to go to. We were ping-ponged back and forth between lawmakers and the DOC. This ombuds office would give family members somewhere to go to air their issues, to ask for resolution, to make suggestions, to make the correction system better for everybody.
Rebecca, what would you say to, say, a state lawmaker who is skeptical of this idea, said, you know, maybe, but the money is not there, or it's not a good investment of our money?
We believe wholeheartedly that with all of the problems that we're facing in Wisconsin in our prison system, that an ombuds office would be able to address multiple issues at the same time and be an independent resource for our lawmakers and our citizens as to what is really going on and what we really do need to address and change. We have begged Republicans all across the state to consider it. There's many things that cost a lot of money in our state. This is not one of them. The average cost of an ombuds office across the country is 0.1% of that corrections budget. So it's hardly anything when we're talking about a budget of $2 billion in Wisconsin.
And to build off of that, the Department of Corrections has already contracted with Falcon, which is essentially an ombuds type organization. So they spent $500,000 on a review last year, and they're going to contract with them again this year, which is great because it's going to help address issues. But that isn't a long-term solution because we're not getting an office in place that can be invested for the long run and look at short-term and long-term goals.
Rebecca, as we start to wrap up, we've focused in particular on the costs facing people who are incarcerated and their families. As you advocate for changes in our jail and prison system, is there a mindset change you think we need, a culture change to find the best way to help people come out of the incarceration system and not end up back there again?
Yes. I think in Wisconsin, we need to ask ourselves, do we want rehabilitation or do we want punitive punishment? And I think people are under the impression that people go to prison to receive drug treatment and mental health services and things that would, you know, help them be successful when they come out. But that is not the case. And there's a lot of varying opinions on whether people should be miserable or be rehabilitated. And I can tell you that misery does not make anybody better. And over 90% of the people in our prisons are coming back to our communities, whether they received the help that they needed or not. And so we have to be honest with ourselves. You know, being away from home and away from your family and away from communities is supposed to be the punishment. We have to do more to get people on their feet when they come home. It's so important.
We'll leave it there. Susan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
And Rebecca, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having us.
That's Rebecca Aubert and Susan Franzen with the group Ladies of SCI, a group that lobbies on behalf of incarcerated people and their loved ones in Wisconsin. We talked to them about financial burdens for incarcerated people and their families and what's being done to change it. The State Department of Corrections provided a statement to the legislature about two proposed laws that would mandate expanded access to personal care items in prison. The statement lists the items currently provided and goes on to say, quote, while DOC generally supports expanding access to additional hygiene and feminine hygiene products, the department would be unable to absorb the additional costs to fund such a mandate. The statement says the funding provided by the bills would not be enough and, quote, our agency would welcome the opportunity to implement these changes safely and sustainably, but respectfully request the funding to do so.
Coming up, a National Museum exhibit shares the art of Ho-Chunk sculptor Truman Lowe. Find out how Wisconsin's forests and rivers shaped his art.
As a woodland Indian, that was very central to who he was, and he spent a lot of time walking the woods outside of Black River Falls.
That's ahead on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
A new exhibit in the nation's capital honors a legendary Wisconsin artist, Ho-Chunk sculptor Truman Lowe.
I want to create enough interest in water through my work that others will begin to share the same beauty and the same understanding that I have of moving water.
That's Lowe speaking in a short film documentary about his work.
Lowe, who passed away in 2019, left a strong mark on the Wisconsin art scene. In 2022, UW La Crosse named their art building after Lowe, and his artwork can be viewed around the state in museums, in outdoor installations like his effigy bird form sculpture near an indigenous mound site in Madison.
Now, the National Museum of the American Indian is honoring Lowe's work with a retrospective called Water's Edge, The Art of Truman Lowe. It's on display at the museum in Washington, D.C. until January 2027.
Joe Ortel is professor emeritus of art history at Beloit College and author of the book Woodland Reflections, The Art of Truman Lowe. And Rebecca Troutman is assistant curator of contemporary art at the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian in Washington, D.C. Rebecca, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Joe, thanks for being with us.
Sure, no problem.
Now, Joe, Truman Lowe, a big name in the art world, especially here in Wisconsin. We've got the Lowe Center for the Arts named after him at UW-La Crosse, a major sculpture of his on the UW-Madison campus. What can you tell us about Lowe's career here in Wisconsin?
Well, let's see. Where do I
start? So much, yeah.
Exactly. He started out, he grew up in Black River Falls, outside Black River Falls at the Indian Mission, and then he went to UW-La Crosse and graduated after several years. I mean, it took him a little while to finish. But then from there, he went to Valders, Wisconsin, to teach high school art. And then he came here to Madison to get his MFA. And from there, then he went briefly to Kansas to teach and then came back and was pretty much here for the rest of his life, living in Madison, with the exception of 8 years that he spent in Washington, D.C. with Rebecca.
And Rebecca, let's go to Washington now. Lowe had a national reputation, worked as a curator there at the National Museum of the American Indian. What kind of significance does his work have in the broader world of Native arts and, I guess, art period?
You know, he's a really significant figure in contemporary Native American art. I actually had studied his work in graduate school and saw him speak as a guest speaker at the University of New Mexico before coming to work with him at the National Museum of the American Indian. And he just brought such a thoughtful approach to curating, to building the collection of contemporary art here at the museum, and to building the exhibition program for contemporary art as well.
Joe, we just heard that clip from the documentary about Truman Lowe, and I saw you react when you heard his voice. Talk about him as a person a little bit before we dig into the art.
Oh, he was so tranquil, just like that voice sounded. He had a very gentle kind of personality, and he was also incredibly generous. So I think that all sort of comes through when you listen to his voice. It's just kind of that peaceful, tranquil kind of approach.
And Rebecca, in that moment from the documentary, he's talking about water, and this Smithsonian exhibit is called Water's Edge. What is it that fascinated him about water, and how does he express that through his art?
Sure. So he grew up along the Black River in Wisconsin, near Black River Falls, spent a lot of time along the river and along its tributary streams, you know, growing up with his family, and really developed this lifelong fascination with moving water, and specifically rivers, streams, waterfalls, not so much lakes and ponds, but was really interested in the movement of the water, the energy, the changing surface reflections. And you really see that in both his sculptures, where he really transformed solid wood into this fluid, sometimes turbulent, sometimes placid water, as well as in his pastel and charcoal drawings.
And not just the water, but other landscapes in Wisconsin, including woodlands. Joe, can you talk a little more about how he connected with this landscape and, again, showed that in his art?
Well, he really felt that was the Ho-Chunk. That was his heritage, that as a woodland Indian, that was very central to who he was. And he spent a lot of time walking the woods out at the mission outside of Black River Falls with his father and, as Rebecca said, playing and fishing and that sort of thing. So he was really embedded in this landscape, I think.
And Joe, before we move on from the kind of art he did, you are interested in his pastels as well, not just this the wood and the water.
Yes. Well, I'm interested in all of it. I think it's all got an incredible aesthetic. But the drawings in particular, they haven't been seen as much, but the pastels, they're just exquisite. His sense of color. He often talked about his mother having a really great talent with color in her splint plait basketry. But his was equally with pastels. It was just an amazing kind of range that he had.
A while back on the show, we talked to Cloris Lowe, a Ho-Chunk artist and educator with a studio in central Wisconsin, great nephew of Truman Lowe. Here's a listen of someone he had to say.
Truman Wanahita, he is my grandfather's brother. I always knew him as Uncle True. He has always been a big proponent of contemporary artwork, contemporary Native artwork being shown, and to have his work now be out at the Smithsonian is just an incredible thing. And he was still supposed to be around when this was happening. He just happens to have left a little bit before the show went up.
The voice of Cloris Lowe there. Now, Truman Lowe passed away in 2019. Rebecca, Truman had worked there, as we mentioned, at the Smithsonian as a curator. How much influence does he have or has he had on how his work now is being displayed there at the museum?
You know, I worked with Truman for several years here at the museum, and I really had hoped to be able to work directly with him on this exhibition. Sadly, as Clara said, he did pass away before we got to that point. But I'm so grateful I was able to have conversations with him about the exhibition and about the about better understanding his thinking behind his work, how he wanted it to be shown, and how he thought about his materials, how he wanted it to be cared for over time. So that did really inform the way that we show his work here.
Joe, how significant is it for this Wisconsin artist to have this really central exhibit in Washington, D.C. at the Museum of the American Indian?
It's magnificent. It really is kind of stunning. And it's all due to Rebecca, honestly. She's really done a beautiful job putting it all together. But he was, during his lifetime, he was very active in sort of raising awareness of Native arts of the upper Midwest. And so it's really nice that it's sort of now coming back to him, and he's gaining the recognition from the nation, basically.
We're talking about a retrospective of Ho-Chunk sculptor Truman Lowe on display at the Museum of the American Indian in Washington, D.C. We have Joe Ortel, art historian and professor emerita from Beloit College, and Rebecca Troutman from the Smithsonian, who curated that exhibit. Rebecca, could you paint us a picture? Walk us through the exhibit. What are we seeing?
Sure. So the exhibition includes 48 of Truman's artworks, including 28 from our own collection and loans from other of significant works from other collections. It's organized thematically around four key and intersecting themes that he returned to again and again throughout his career. Moving water is one of the primary themes. Also, landscape and place and human relationships to that place. Woodland structures, he was really interested in the structures of dwellings as well as canoes. And then memory and shared knowledge, so the ways that that important knowledge is kind of encoded and preserved and then passed on.
I want to talk about some of the specific pieces. There are some images on the museum's website from the exhibit. I'm looking at one right now. It's called Ottawa, and it really seems like at a central place here, a big installation with this almost stepwise structure with these viney or tree materials cascading down. Joe, can you talk a little bit about this piece?
Sure, yeah. Those are strips of pine that are 8 feet long or 10 feet long, and he's just sort of attached them at one end to that triangular wedge-shaped structure. And so it's meant to evoke Ottawa, the River Ottawa in Ottawa City. It was made for a 1992 exhibit called Land Spirit Power, which was about Native Nations artists. And so I think it really captures both that idea of water made from wood, first of all, and then also that idea of place that Rebecca was just talking about. He visited Ottawa and he saw that river and that gushing water and really responded to it.
And Rebecca, I've read interviews, I think, with both of you where you mention that Lowe had a gift for making wood look like water. And looking at this piece, I hope people look at it online, it's like a waterfall, a cascade made out of wood. Is this is a common theme in Lowe's work?
It is, and he really had this incredible ability to be able to transform solid wood into, you know, fluid water. It's really, really amazing. As Joe mentioned, so this is made with these thin strips of wood that kind of recall the strips of wood that his parents used in making baskets. And so he had an understanding of the kind of fluidity, the flexibility, but also the strength of wood when it was cut into these thin strips. And he was able to use it to really suggest these turbulent, dramatic waterfalls.
Rebecca, I want to look at some of the other works in the exhibit. There's a sculptural work called Feather Canoe, some pastel paintings, multimedia works with feathers and glass beads. What are some of the through threads of Lowe's style that we see and experience as we go through the exhibit?
So one of the key things that I think you see is the materials he worked with. So when he was younger, he experimented with, plastics, resins, different kinds of synthetic materials. But after graduate school, he made a conscious decision to return to the natural materials that he'd been surrounded by growing up, particularly woods, especially willow, but also feathers, strips of leather sometimes used to fasten works together, stones. And so the work Feather Canoe is really significant. He was very interested in the form of the canoe. He talked about it as this kind of ideal architectural form, perfectly suited for the waters that it was meant to travel, and how little it's changed since it was first created. And so the Feather Canoe in particular, it's just made with these peeled willow saplings fastened together with strips of leather, or actually in this case, pieces of copper. And then there are white feathers suspended within the canoe so that it really gives it a sense of floating, the sense of just, you know, flying along the water.
And Joe, since you've retired from teaching at Beloit College, I understand you're kind of an evangelist almost, spreading Lowe's work around the country. What does that look like? Where has that taken you?
We started during COVID and shortly after Truman passed away. And I was really interested in making sure that public museums across the country were aware of his work. And if they were interested in buying the work, that they would have a chance to, because we know that Truman would have wanted his work to be seen by a wide audience rather than just be in private collections.
I got to say, Rebecca, growing up X number of years ago, I think if I was at a museum and I saw something by Native American artists, it was an artifact, it was ascribed to a tribe or maybe a region or something like that. How important is it that we're seeing not just that, but artists, right? A name, a creative personality behind that art?
It's so important, both for the creators to be identified and also just to help people recognize that Indigenous people, Native American people are, you know, contemporary living people working as artists, working as educators, as curators, you know, in so many other capacities, and that these are, you know, living, vibrant, thriving cultures.
And in addition, it's not just that artists are working in one tradition, like making beadwork or doing craft work. There's a whole range of possibilities, and Native artists are doing all of it, really.
And Rebecca, I'm wondering, you know, we've got this exhibit with lots of this material. What happens to all of this material when the exhibit is over? Is it going to be going back to regional places where we could see it around the country?
So there are a couple of things I can say to that. So when much of the work, as I said, is in our collection, so it will be here. We'll be able to continue to exhibit it. But there will be an announcement coming soon about the exhibition traveling back to Wisconsin. So stay tuned for that.
Oh, and Joe, our producer told me you are interested in hearing from people who have a low work in their home. Give a shout out. What do you want to know?
I would love to know people. I know he donated artworks to the public TV auctions every year, and I would love to be in touch with people who got some of those pieces or who just had pieces of his in general. I'm very excited to find out what's here in town and in the area.
We'll leave it there. Jill, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Rebecca, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
That's Rebecca Trautman, Assistant Curator of Contemporary Art at the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian in Washington, D.C. And Joe Ortel, Professor Emeritus of Art History at Beloit College and author of the book Woodland Reflections, The Art of Truman Lowe. We've been talking about Ho-Chunk artist Truman Lowe from the Black River Falls area. An exhibition of his work is on display at the National Museum of the American Indian. It runs through January of next year. A new federal initiative aims to provide selected drugs at lower costs, and it just kicked off. The White House labels it Trump RX and bills it as a cheaper alternative. Analysts say it's a work in progress. Savings could depend on people's insurance status and other factors.
We're going to dig into prescription costs on a future program, and we want to hear from you. Are you having trouble dealing with the cost of your medications? If you have insurance, does it make medication affordable?
And have you looked into or tried alternate sources of prescription meds, like the new federal website, commercial commercial sites like GoodRx, providers of imported drugs from Canada, or even old-fashioned shopping around from one pharmacy to another.
We want to hear your experiences and the impact of prescription drug costs on your life. Email us at wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text us. That number is 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today producers include Lauren Cox, Beatrice Lawrence, and Rochelle Wilson.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful.
Learn more about us at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.